You're listening to the 21st Century Change Agent Show, the podcast created to inspire you to make a meaningful change in your family, organization, or community, so we can all enjoy the benefits of living in the 21st century. My name is Bybee Ziga, and I'm a proud millennial, entrepreneur, and a consultant at Lakehouse Consulting, where we inspire individuals and organizations to think differently. On this show, I'm sitting down with real change makers to talk about their journey on making an impact and driving one community at a time into the 21st century. Thank you for listening. Welcome to this episode, everyone, and thank you for tuning in. The topic of today's episode is disability and accessibility. I wanted to have a conversation on this topic early on my podcast for two reasons. First of all, it is a very personal subject to me, which you'll hear more about as you continue to listen. And secondly, having been in the business world, I know that this is one of those taboo subjects that has a lot of stigma associated with it. And many leaders, including HR leaders, still find this a very uncomfortable subject to cover. I have witnessed all sorts of awkward conversations, moments of silence, ignorance, and some truly inspirational moments. However, they are too far and few. Before we go into the conversation, I wanted to draw your attention to two models, which you may or may have not heard of: the medical model of disability and the social model of disability. The medical model views disability as a problem that belongs to the individual with impairment. It is not seen as an issue to concern anyone else but the disabled person. So, for example, if a person in a wheelchair faces steps, that is an issue with the wheelchair and the disability associated with it rather than the steps. Ultimately, the disabled person needs to adapt to fit into the society. On the other hand, social model sees the steps as a disabling barrier. This model suggests that it is the society that disables a person, and ultimately a person only becomes disabled when the society excludes them because of their impairment or condition. So if the barriers are removed, these people become enabled, even though the impairment has not changed. And removing these physical and mental barriers are the responsibility of the society. On today's episode, I am having a bold and open conversation with Molly Watt, who has experienced every barrier that comes with the Usher syndrome that she was diagnosed with as a child. So please share this conversation and let me know your thoughts and feelings by using hashtag ChangeAgentPodcast on Twitter. Thank you for listening. Molly, thank you so much for agreeing to come on my show and go into the details on the topics of disability and accessibility. It is a very important topic to cover, and I know you're personally very passionate about educating people around you and in organisations on this subject. So I'm very excited to have you here and have this conversation with you.
I know. Yeah, it's great. Thanks for having me.
What I would like to start with, to set the scene for this conversation, is for you to share a bit of your journey with us and give us a flavour of what it has meant for you to try defining yourself in today's society and the world of institution and industry.
Cool. Okay. I'm registered deafblind due to a condition called Usher syndrome, which is the most common cause of congenital deaf blindness. And what that means is I was born deaf and had no idea that the onset of blindness was to come during my adolescence years. So once the blindness came along, which is an eye condition called retinitis pigmentosa, I was about 12 years old, so I was in education, experiencing obviously the general hormone issues as well. It was a real challenge, and with retinitis pigmentosa being a progressive blindness, my sight deteriorated quite quickly, quicker than others predicted. I went from being partially sighted at 12 years old to severely sight impaired, which is politically correct for blind, at the age of 14. So I was kind of forced to you kind of try and make best use out of the tools that I had to completely succeed in my education. There was a lot of misconceptions around deafblindness. A lot of my teachers and supporters were really quite stuck on how to look after me. You know, I had a teacher of the deaf who was great at the deaf side of things, and a teacher of the blind who was great at the blind side of things, but they knew nothing about the other. So I was always sort of this guinea pig, and in the middle, sort of this teenager who just didn't really understand herself, like what I was going through. So it was really, really tricky. So with that said, I struggled a lot with sort of mental health problems. I was quite depressed, anxious, really didn't see having a future. I kind of just thought that my life was done, to be honest. But having the most supportive family's background and everything, I got through. I got to college, and I succeeded in my English literature and language A-level and an art and design diploma, which a lot of people would say is ironic for a deafblind person to study art and English. I actually got into university. I wanted to be a teacher, primary school teacher, but this is where I was hit with a wall of ignorance all over again. Lecturers, staff, just all of all kinds. Well, how are you going to be able to teach then if you can't see or hear properly? And it was just very much that attitude that defeated me in the end, despite the fact that I spent so many years since my diagnosis building myself up with the help of my family and friends, using the tools that I had. To do really well and prove people wrong, and then to get to university where I really thought I was going to find my feet and jump into my future, I was kind of hit back again. In hindsight, I probably could have stayed and fought it out a little bit longer, but I think at that point I was very much at crossroads. I also had a part-time job at Apple, and the contrast in treatment was huge. Like, Apple treated me amazingly, and they saw potential in my unique skill set. And so I kind of just decided to call university a day, call it a day with them, and kind of continue with my part-time job at Apple and do some overtime. So this is kind of where kind of it didn't start at Apple in terms of tech and digital, because I think I hadn't realized prior to that how impactful the technology I had been using, because I'd just got so used to strategizing the tools I had. And when people would say, well, how do you do that? And I'd be like, well, I just do. So it wasn't really until I got to Apple and I was blogging about my experiences with technology, and, you know, people like started getting contacted to sort of test tech and kind of run some testing on websites, you know, go to museums and test out the experience from the perspective of a deafblind person. And also, obviously, being deafblind, I'm able to empathize with other people that have sensory impairments. So I actually left Apple. I left and I pursued a career of being self-employed. I kind of did a lot of keynote speaking. So it kind of starts with that awareness, like why it's so important to consider accessibility and inclusive design. And then I managed to get a contract, a job with a web design agency up in Macclesfield called Sigma. And I basically do a lot of help with their user testing. We basically design websites, and I will test it out to see how accessible it is, and so on and so forth.
Thank you, Molly. I know you spend a lot of your time training businesses, big and small, and looking at ways to create more inclusive experience that does not only meet the needs of disabled audiences, but targets a wider group of society that would not identify themselves as disabled, but would still benefit from accessible design. What are some of the key misconceptions you face in your role as a consultant when it comes to accessible design?
I spend a lot of my time trying to get people to understand that we're not just targeting those minority groups. Of course, we don't want to leave them behind, and they are always going to be a focus. But we have to eradicate that thought process that says we have this really small group of people, very specific sort of type of person that we're designing for. So, for instance, blind people, all blind people use screen readers, people often think. Well, actually, that's incorrect. I'm blind, I have 5 degrees vision left, and I actually use that as much as I can. I'm actually, ironically, very visual for a blind person. And that always shocks people because people are like, but I thought blind people didn't see anything. Well, actually, around 90%, if not more, blind people actually have useful vision. No blind person sees nothing. So it's about kind of trying to use a tool, use technology to impact everybody's lives, but using the perspective of being quite open-minded when it comes to these groups of people and not assuming that there's one size fits all, because that's absolutely not the case. When I walk into the room, I say I'm registered deafblind, that brings on a lot of questions and curiosity because I'm not what people expect. You know, oh, you talk really well for a deaf person, or oh, you don't look like a blind person. And these are just ridiculous things that I get told, you know, all the time, which is fine. I just put it down to lack of awareness. But it's kind of, you know, it's time to educate everybody on this, because the sooner people understand that, the sooner people will start to design and develop products and services to be fully inclusive for all people.
Thank you so much, Molly. I mean, I've got probably about 100 questions for you. But ultimately, from being in the business world and from the business perspective, I think even before you can start designing inclusive environment for people, be it physical, yeah, be it technology, leaders or decision makers who make decisions around this environment need to have a level of education and understanding and empathy of those, yeah, people and people who go through it. But how can you get that if you don't have anyone, be it on your board or within an organization, who represent those groups of people? Obviously, we all know that the topic of disability has got a lot of stigma associated with it. And I've been on, you know, various, you know, belonging and inclusion and similar steering committees, where the moment the topic hits disability, it just ends up being a very awkward conversation. Yeah. Again, just because the people in the room do not know how to start or address these conversations. Yeah. And what it comes down to in a lot of cases is the terminology and what language people use when they refer to disability. So recently I read a debate on Twitter, which arose after a diversity and inclusion conference, where diversity and inclusion leaders had used the phrase differently abled. And most people were saying that the correct term is disabled, and able-bodied people shouldn't shy away from the term just because it makes them uncomfortable. Yet there was another share of people who prefer the term differently abled, saying that they do not see themselves as disabled, even though a certain functionality of their bodies have been taken away. So can we talk about these terms a little bit? So the ones that have come across, you know, so far have included, you know, disabled, differently abled, mobility challenged, people with special needs, impaired. Mm-hmm. And recently I've also come across the term functional diversity. So what is appropriate use of, so what is appropriate use by people who are able-bodied and avoid these conversations because they don't want to get it wrong, they don't want to upset anyone, they don't want to belittle anyone? Could we have a bit of a sort of rundown? What is acceptable and what isn't?
So it's a really interesting question, and like you say, it's often a debate, because as I said a minute ago, it's not one size fits all. You're going to find within communities, everyone has different opinions. So for instance, in the deaf community, it's kind of split into two, where you have the capital D deaf and the lowercase d deaf people. Capital D deaf people are known to be very proud to be deaf. They use BSL. Some of them don't even wear hearing aids or cochlear implants. They don't believe in them. You know, they're just very proud to be deaf. And then you get lowercase d deaf people, which are people like myself that have often been brought up in hearing families, oral, might know a bit of sign language, but as a second language. And we have hearing friends and we socialise with hearing people. So already there's that division. And I actually personally have been sort of victimised by the capital D deaf community because I am the way I am. I went to a school for the deaf and they bullied me because I didn't know sign language and I was a sad excuse of a deaf person. And so that was what was interesting, because prior to going to school for the deaf, I had heard a lot of, you know, hearing impaired. That was a term that was often used, and I was used to it. I didn't really know any different. I didn't personally take offence because I've been born that way, and I've been around a lot of medical professionals and adults that have used it. Because in the medical industry, the term hearing impaired and visually impaired is quite widely used. But when I got to the school for the deaf, it was like, no, we are deaf, you know, deaf. And you know, none of this hard of hearing or hearing impaired or anything like that, because they don't want to be seen that there's something wrong with you. There's nothing wrong with being deaf, we're fine the way we are. So it's that very attitude that, you know, that varies massively in all disabled communities. Now, I personally, with even the word disability, is quite a funny one. So again, I'm 26 years old now, and I've been diagnosed around 13 years with Usher syndrome, but obviously been deaf my whole life. The term disabled has not really been something that has resonated with me. I don't often introduce myself as someone with, oh, I'm a disabled person. I would say I'm registered deafblind. I have this condition called Usher syndrome, which is a combination of vision and hearing loss. But it's a mouthful. You often have to find yourself explaining yourself all the time, because I often found before, and unfortunately, I would say hearing or visually impaired, and it almost didn't come across like it was severe enough, because then people would look at me and be like, well, you seem fine to me. It's almost like some people need that level of confirmation to prove that I have a severe disability, which is totally wrong. But from the perspective of benefits and all of that, you know, fighting to get what I'm eligible for because of the lack of mobility and accessibility and independence growing up, it was a real challenge and battle even to get into the school for deaf. At first they were saying I wasn't deaf enough. So there is definitely a stigma around, you know, terminology in the first place. And as you have already mentioned, it's always going to be a constant debate, unfortunately. There isn't a right or wrong answer. I recently joined in on some deaf training, actually, at one of the companies I work with at Sigma. It was an interesting one, because I went along, and the lady that led it was a capital D deaf lady, and there was an interpreter with her. And it was clear quite early on, I felt, that it was the capital D deaf perspective on the deaf community and the deaf world and all of that, because they talked about jargon, and they said hearing impaired is an absolute no-no. And I had been working at the company for quite a while, and I'd always said to them, oh, hearing impaired is fine for me, but I'd always said that it's not the same for everybody. So it is a really weird one, because even in the blind community, for instance, you've got partially sighted and then severe sighted and severely sighted impaired. So it's kind of trying to show the different levels of severity. So it's a really, really tricky one. So my advice would be, is when you know you're meeting someone or you've met someone, ask them, like, literally just straight out of the barrel, how would you like me to you know, refer to this, or what do you call it yourself? And what, sometimes when they introduce themselves, they say I'm visually impaired or I'm deaf or whatever, you go from that. I've also found I have a blue badge, you know, and obviously all the disabled bays have wheelchair icons. Obviously it's an international accessibility icon, and it is a person in a wheelchair. And I couldn't tell you how many times I've gotten out of the car with my mum, who obviously drove and not me for obvious reasons. And we've had, you know, older, angry people, and not just all older people, but lots of different kinds of people angry at us and assuming that we were just taking the mic and parking in a disabled bay because I appear able-bodied. And then they see my guide dog dump out of the back and, you know, they don't say anything. So it's that the term disability, I find, definitely is straight on associated with someone with a wheelchair. And so when it comes to asking for assistance at airport, I'll say, can I please get some assistance, or I book it in advance. I turn up to the airport and they wheeled out a wheelchair for me to sit in. And that's just that level of assumption where they've not just thought, this person's requested assistance. Let's ask what kind of assistance they need. They've just gone, assistance means wheelchair means disability. So that very stereotypical approach is definitely not the best, not recommended. And again, is why I recommend asking them more questions. Is definitely okay. And some people feel awkward asking questions, but honestly, from someone with a disability myself, I would much rather you ask a question rather than assume.
Thank you for the run through, Molly, and for more of your sort of more personal experiences with this as well. Thank you for sharing. I think the key message here is do not assume or make conclusions about someone's condition when they mention that they need assistance or reasonable adjustments of any kind. Ask. That simple. And speaking of reasonable adjustments, whenever you've interviewed for roles, do you get this question often enough, or do you just tend to surprise people by arriving to the interview with your guide dog?
And that's also a really, really good question. So unfortunately, I have experienced a lot of prejudice and discrimination when it comes to trying to get a job. And that started when I was 16 and just applying at Waitrose, just to work in a supermarket because all my friends have part-time jobs. I wanted a part-time job. I wanted to earn my own money. And so I really struggled with that approach, as you said, like when do I mention it or do I not mention it? And as a 16-year-old young disabled person, I certainly didn't have the confidence, to be honest, to say, oh, by the way, I'm deafblind, here I am, take me as I am, I'm still very much employable. I didn't have that confidence then because society had kind of made me feel that I wasn't really worthy at that point. But I had social services involved, and I had this I can't remember what her title was, but she was basically someone from social services, was that a job coach, I think she was. So she basically would help me get a job. And she contacted all of the local places, you know, all the supermarkets and things like that, and has said, you know, got a keen young lady who would really like to, you know, come along and work and, you know, blah, 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 blah. And she is also deafblind. And mentioned Usher syndrome, but of course a lot of people don't know what Usher syndrome is, or they wouldn't care to do the research or anything like that. And Waitrose, which was just down the road from us, and it would have been perfect, they had literally said, oh no, sorry, we're not employing at the minute. And literally that week I'd gone out for dinner with one of my friends that I went to primary school with. And she said, and she actually works at Waitrose. And she said, oh, did you hear that so-and-so all have got jobs at Waitrose? And I was like, oh, well, that's funny, because I was told they weren't taking on. So sadly, a few of those experiences have happened, and it's not an uncommon thing. And I've often been asked about this thing when it comes to having a disability and when to approach it. So when I worked at Apple, it was a slightly different angle, because I had a friend that worked at Apple and her mum who worked at Apple, and they both referred me. And now Apple are obviously typically known to be a very diverse, inclusive company anyway. But that said, that way, it wasn't as easy as that. You know, I had to do 4 interviews to get that job. Lots and lots of people. And I would rock up there with my guide dog. And I was so nervous. But there was something about, as soon as I turned up, I knew that I was in safe hands. I knew that these guys weren't looking at me as a disabled person. They were looking at me as a genuine part of their team, like someone who could potentially make really good position at the store, and they saw positives in it, and that did wonders for my confidence. So I was like, you know what, it's so nice to walk into the room and to not have to walk in with Usher syndrome stapled on my head or deafblind stapled. And I liked the fact that they were embracing that, you know, they were embracing me as an individual who had a disability, kind of just as part of who I was, not who I was altogether. In terms of like advice for people, because I often get asked this, is an interesting one, because I think now that I have that confidence, I would give in the CV and not say anything. And then if it gets to a point where they invite me into the interview, and there's a thing that asks about special requirements or anything like that, then I may well mention. But that said, in terms of special requirements, I don't really need too much besides, you know, no background noise, like a quiet room, and, you know, clear communication. But these are things that I would expect from any interview anyway. So I might not even ask for special assistance. I would just turn up. but that's because I've spent years sort of building up my confidence to get to this point.
A really interesting example about Apple, and, you know, the moment you walked through the door, you said you felt welcome and you felt like you're in a safe pair of hands.
Yeah.
So what do you think sets them apart from other employers in terms of their recruitment strategy? Do you think, and obviously you've been part of the team, do they get special training around, you know, people with disabilities? Do they have, is it only because, you know, it's part of their culture, or maybe they only employ people who are open to working with people from diverse communities? So what sets apart this demographic that works at Apple?
So I think, as I mentioned, they don't look at you as someone with a disability. Like, I kind of always grew up knowing that when you walked into an Apple store, there was always be people with, you know, green hair, pink hair, piercings, you know, that just, it was just, they embraced that individuality, and I always loved that. So I think just knowing that they already had that sort of attitude automatically made me feel comfortable. The thing that would set me apart from, you know, others that were able-bodied was we had a system to know that everyone was reassured that, like, me and my guide dog would be safely out of the building. And so what they did is they paired me up with someone on the shop floor at any given time and said that, you know, should there be a fire alarm or, you know, any kind of alarm, this person will come and find you and this person will help assist you out of the building. So that, you know, and that's quite simple when you think about it. That's a very simple thing.
The key thing here to me is that Apple treated these aspects as basics and had thought about them long before you arrived.
Yeah.
Another aspect, of course, is that they're hiring people with impairments and disabilities. So with time, it just becomes second nature and part of the culture that no one questions or is surprised about.
Exactly.
So I guess the important thing here is to not be afraid in making that first step and hiring someone with accessibility needs. And one hopefully leads to another. From having worked in and with large corporates, what I often find is a policy. Mm. Disability policy, trans policy, you name it. And it's often there to police people. The fact that you write a disability or accessibility policy doesn't suddenly make you inclusive.
Yeah.
There's more work that goes into it. And instead, I potentially see more value add in creating an accessibility statement that frames the commitment to the work of Access and the disabled community. For instance, performing service disability audits for barriers to access, like does your website features an accessibility plugin and so on.
My feeling would be that policy for some people would make it that bit more official. The kind of attitude and inclusivity that I talk about is something that's implemented from the very get-go, and it's implemented in every single thing that they do, whether it's recruitment or events or in their shops or online. Every single team should have some kind of knowledge on accessibility, whether it be basic or not. You mentioned about accessibility plugins on the website. Those are a pet hate of mine because I really feel those plugins, you know, it's like a stamp on a website. Like, look at us, we've considered accessibility, but they haven't actually tested it with real life people, because as soon as someone like myself uses our tools, our assistive technology, they're not compatible with them. They don't actually work. So it defeats the object of actually having them. And all it's done is it's just stuck a stamp on their website to make it look like they've considered it. And to me, that's not considering, that's completely missing the mark when you're talking about inclusivity and accessibility. Mm-hmm. That just says to me that this is a company that has thought about it, but not very well. And they've just gone, oh, let's just stick that on there. Job done.
But for you, I'm sure that would work as a red flag that perhaps this organization has thought about it, put it on their website as a stamp, as you say, and yet not tested it with actual people who would use this function. One thing is putting a disability disclaimer at the end of a job description or a website, and the other is actually walking your talk. I guess a great way for you to see that could be as simple as logging onto their website and assessing whether they actually have invested in something as simple as accessibility plugin. Because I assume that would already indicate the potential culture you might be faced in should you choose to work for or with this company.
It could also be seen as a challenge, though, because I think it depended on the role that you were applying for. If it was specific to be within the design team or back-end, front-end, and you would have some kind of impact on those decisions being made onto the website, and you felt that you could influence those decisions to guide them in a way to be more accessible. Mm. I think that can be used as kind of an example, like when you can say, you know, everything has room for improvement. The thing, like what I should say is that it's good that people are thinking about it. People do think about it. It's just about bringing it to the forefront of their brains, their minds and their business, because as soon as they start doing that, we're not leaving anybody behind. And you're not just benefiting people with disabilities, you're benefiting so many more people than that.
That's absolutely right. Well, we've talked about business, but I'd like to add another layer to this conversation and talk about the role of government and public institutions. So recently, I read that Deutsche Bank research has suggested that remote workers should be taxed an additional 5% of their salary because they choose to work remotely, and this would be paid by the employer. Deutsche Bank strategists and analysts contributing to this research argue that working from home culture benefits people who can work from home, and therefore this money should be used to support key workers, which up to this point perhaps makes sense. However, the layer I lack in this research is the impact of such tax on disabled communities that finally do not face physical barriers of work and can work from the safety of their own homes and with their own tools. And people with disabilities already face more costs and less remuneration. And the disability employment gap is still very high. According to Office for National Statistics, or ONS, this currently stands at nearly 30%. So what this suggests to me is that this research has not consulted nor considered the impact of such tax on disabled communities. And representation matters. For instance, here is another example of an article I read a couple of weeks ago where a Joint Committee on Vaccination and Immunisation, so JCVI, have categorised people on basis of the priority that they would access the vaccine following Pfizer's announcement of their version of this vaccine. And they have suggested on how this vaccine should be distributed among the society once it comes. So what they've said is that care home workers and residents are the top priority. Then comes healthcare workers and citizens over 80 plus, followed by 75 plus, 70 plus, 65 plus, and so on. So people have been categorized by age rather than by the level of need. Even though the COVID-19 figures say that 3/5 of deaths have been within disabled community. So how does that make you feel?
I've thought to myself, like, I don't know, at what point do I say I'm vulnerable enough to, you know, need to be sort of prioritised for the vaccine. If you have a condition and you come down with a cold or you have hay fever or something, your whole kind of body kind of gives up on you and you feel tired and deflated, and then you have symptoms of depression and all of that. So you can be wiped out for weeks. So, you know, I was sort of thinking, oh, right, so in that ordering that you mentioned, you know, obviously it goes by care workers and then down by age and all of that, I'm thinking, oh my goodness, I'm 26, so I'll be sort of, you know, right at the bottom of the list. And yeah, so like you're saying, that's because of that lack of understanding and consideration for us. And there's a lot of us, there's a lot of people with disabilities and impairments and things like that. There's so many, like in the UK, you're looking at around 20% of people in the UK that have some form of long-term disability. But that said, those are people that are obviously diagnosed with disabilities. There's so many people that go undiagnosed, people that don't identify themselves with disabilities. That's what we've been talking about. And then all of those that have impairments and just access needs for whatever reason. And so why aren't we being considered when it's such a big group of people?
That's right. So ultimately, what this JCVI prioritisation list suggests is that a marathon running 65-year-old is a higher priority for vaccination than an immunosuppressed and ventilation-dependent 20-year-old. I'm not suggesting at any point that one group of people is more important and privileged than the other. What I am implying is that this prioritisation activity fundamentally lacks credibility due to clear lack of representation. On this occasion, Baroness Jane Campbell, who because of her diagnosis is classed as clinically extremely vulnerable, noted this and said that she'd get this raised with the House of Lords. In this example again, if it wasn't for Baroness Campbell's representation, this would likely go unaddressed. We are talking about businesses creating local policy, and yet here we have higher institutions that are supposed to represent and look after all of its citizens and residents equally, doing a fundamentally poor job. They have a huge say in and influence over, for instance, public infrastructure and access. And there I say, it still needs a lot of attention. So I'm going to share a very personal example. So my brother is in a wheelchair following an accident a few years ago. Where he lives, he needs to cross a river over a bridge to get into the city. Now, the pedestrian bridge near his home was recently renovated and for the first time ever offers an opportunity for people in wheelchairs and not only, of course, to use it. It was a big thing in the local area, covered by media and celebrating the financial investment local government has made and how much they care for their citizens with accessibility needs. All rainbows and roses at this point. However, they did not create an accessible path for these citizens to actually get to the bridge. So there was my brother with this beautiful bridge on his doorstep, and yet he still needs to use the pavement that runs alongside a very busy road and adds a good half an hour to his journey into the town. And this is not a disabled problem. This is an accessibility issue, because there are parents with prams that also need to access this infrastructure. So it's not only disabled people that we're talking about here.
Yeah, and unfortunately those sort of things are so much more common than we think, because even in the world of design, there's a fantastic example that I use, and this is all because companies that have been told they've got to consider accessibility because it's a legal requirement, they look at the checklist guidelines, so WCAG, and they've gone tick, 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 we've done this. So one of the examples that I show is, and we show at Sigma as well, is there's a picture of so Virgin Trains rolled it out, but thankfully they don't exist anymore because they obviously realized that they weren't working. But what they've done is all of their signs had they were basically the signposts for the toilets on the Virgin trains. On the sign says door locked when lit, and underneath door locked when lit is Braille. And Braille that says door locked when lit. So, of course, if you're a registered blind person who has no useful vision, relying on Braille, you're going to read that braille, you're not going to be able to see that the door is lit. And that is an example of a company that's gone, oh, okay, so we need to make all our signs fully accessible for blind people, so therefore let's put braille on every sign. So they put braille on every single sign, thinking that this was going to meet the need of every single blind person. And firstly, a lot of blind people don't use braille. I don't read braille. And secondly, it's not useful for a blind person anyway, because they're not going to see when the door is lit. Okay. So that's because companies have gone via compliance rather than actually involving users in testing their experience, testing the experience, testing the service, testing the product. They've completely forgotten. They're actually designing for people. And that's exactly what you said with the bridge, like the amount of train stations that I've turned up to. And you've got no way of getting out of the train station except for going over the bridge. And you've got stairs to go up, but you don't have a lift or a ramp or anything like that. You've literally got to rely on staff to carry you if you're in a wheelchair, which is completely demeaning. Like, who would want that? So unfortunately, yeah, these experiences are not rare. There's quite a lot of them. And it all stems back from the lack of awareness, lack of education, and actually just people being quite lazy.
One thing I can say about the UK, though, is people are much more vocal here than in many other countries in Europe.
Yeah.
For instance, I moved to the UK about 10 years ago, and I remember my first months and probably even first couple of years here, I was always very surprised about just how many disabled people you had here. And I'm talking about people in wheelchairs that I saw on the streets. I'm not even talking about people with invisible disabilities. And I was always thinking, wow, we don't have this many people in wheelchairs back home. However, the more I educated myself, and also when the accident happened to my brother and he became wheelchair bound, I realized that wasn't the case at all. The difference was that back home we have very little appropriate infrastructure for people with accessibility needs. As simple as beeping traffic lights to tell visually impaired people when it was safe to cross the road. Our pavements had bumps and humps and often did not have suitable opportunity to safely get off them. Residential buildings had stairs throughout, and very small number of buildings had elevators. This was a Soviet standard. So when my brother became wheelchair bound, he lived in a flat on fifth floor with no lift.
Yeah.
And may I add that the still existing Soviet buildings that we have and they do have lifts, are often not wide enough to fit a wheelchair in them. So we realised that if he returns to that flat after his recovery, he will become a prisoner of his own home.
Oh, gosh.
And we were lucky enough to be able to swap this flat around for a ground floor flat. And we had to do a major renovation on it. So he was able to get out of his own bedroom, get to the bathroom, kitchen, and so on. And we had to fight with local council to get a ramp installed so he can actually get out of his flat. And that's when I realized we do have disabled people. We just don't talk about them. They are the non-existent or invisible citizens, you know. The situation over the past 10 years has undeniably improved. However, it is still nowhere near to be considered adequate.
But this is what astounds me with that, because you're not just ignoring people with wheelchairs, you're forgetting people with prams and babies and trolleys and things like that as well. So what happens if you're on the fifth floor and you've got a family and you've got children and you've got shopping bags and all of this? Like, why build buildings without lifts? I don't understand. This is what, again, when talking about inclusivity, it's just trying to get people to understand that by putting in a ramp or putting in a lift or whatever, you're not just considering people with disabilities. Like, there's so many of us that benefit from the simplicities of a lift. You know, what about when we have heavy baggage or we're holding our children or we've got a pram or whatever? Like, these are very simple things that, you know, that are sort of basic human rights. It really gets me, because it's just like, this is so infuriating when you just think how many of us use a lift. And, you know, and it's just, yeah. My sister's recently had a baby, and obviously pushing around a pram. And my sister, you'll definitely realise now more than ever how trickier it is to actually get from one floor to another. And, you know, when the experience is far more straightforward, and when it's not, because there's some places you go to, you have to really, it's like a maze to try and find where the lift, as you and your brother will know, it's like, it's a real challenge even trying to find a lift or the ramp. And the signage is shocking and inaccessible for people like me. Like my guide dog, she is not escalator trained, so therefore we have to have steps or a lift. And so when we travel on the underground, that can be a real challenge, because not every tube station has them. And so I would have to try and find assistance, which often includes just talking to random strangers in London. And often delightful Londoners are super helpful. They're like, oh, you know, hang on there, love, I'll go and find you someone. But obviously not everyone has that confidence to speak up and say, oh, hi, could you please give me some help?
And it creates a sense of isolation and dependency on others.
Yeah.
Again, going back to the example of my brother, if we had not had the opportunity to swap the fifth floor flat for a ground floor flat, he would have been stuck there by himself all day, every day. Until some of his strong, able-bodied male friends would have come around those few times a year and carried him all the way down and out and then back again. Because I don't need to tell you that it is not an easy job. And he's only in his early 30s. So that aspect of human interaction, friendships and socialization is a huge part of all of our lives. And because of such accident, not only his body ability is taken away, but also other aspects of life that we consider basic human rights and needs.
And this is the thing, and it's so sad, because isolation is horrible. It's horrible. When I hate thinking of anyone isolated, because it can just eat away at you, when actually you're a perfectly capable person that deserves to be a part of society. So if you have your tools, and you know, you have the ability to still communicate and socialize and all of those basic things that, you know, people do on a day to day, even during COVID, you know, if you got FaceTime and Zoom and all of these things to keep connected. I was particularly worried about my granddad, who he's in his early 80s now, and he lives 4 hours away. He lives on his own. And so through lockdown, I was really worried about him. Well, the first lockdown, and obviously now as well. But it was just like, oh, I'd hate to think that he's on his own. And to be honest, don't get me wrong, he's very independent and he's quite happy with his own company. But I was sort of setting up these weekly quiz nights with all our family. And I have to call him up in advance and talk him through how to use FaceTime, because we had bought him an iPad a couple of Christmases ago. And thankfully, where I'd sat down and showed him how to use the iPad using accessibility features that I use, so like large text, high contrast, zoom, magnifier, all of these things, because he's an 81-year-old man. He has very similar access needs to me, and the difference being I'm deafblind and he's an 81-year-old man. And that's why I try and get people to understand, like, sorry, guys, we're all getting older. We're all probably going to require something, and actually we need to get on board with how technology can really help us from an accessibility point of view. And I talk about my dearest old granddad, bless him. So I talk about the iPad, and I say to him, you know, I say to people, you know, I'm more likely now to get a hold of him on FaceTime than I am on his house phone, because he gets on there and he reads the news, he reads the sport stuff, he's got Sudoku and games on there. They keep him occupied and he's happy to do it on his own. But with the quiz nights, I would call him up a couple of days in advance, or the day before in advance. I have to do it every week to remind him, obviously, another old age thing. But I was talking through how to use FaceTime, which was unbelievably hard work. You have to have so much patience. But it was all because I wanted to stay connected with him, because I knew that he was going to be isolated. He's obviously on his own. The thought of isolation, for so I've been isolated, and thankfully I, funnily enough, just before lockdown, the first lockdown started, I was about to move out, and I'm really glad I hadn't, because I don't think I would have been able to cope living independently on my own in lockdown. So I'm quite happy that I still live at home with my family, because I would definitely be struggling with isolation.
Because obviously another thing that you just mentioned, speaking about your granddad, is that, you know, when we talk about accessibility, it's not only referring to disabled communities, we are referring to our senior citizens, you know, we're talking about our, you know, young parents and young mums who need that for, you know, their prams and children and
exactly.
Those things. So accessibility is not only to do with disabled people, it's to do with all of us, and at some point in our lives we will be dealing with it, and we will be stuck in, you know, being in on London TfL thinking, how the hell do I get down that escalator, or how do I, you know, where is the lift, you know, how do I get out of here?
Yeah,
and it's just absolute basics. And you really question the ability of, you know, you really question, you know, who has been part of those, you know, designer groups and those engineer groups who haven't asked some really fundamental questions.
No, often it's about making things look pretty. That's the thing, though, you can find balance. So there's some really great, you know, great user experiences that, you know, look great, modern and fresh, but they're also, you know, accessible.
That's right. This technology is out there, but it's just not as widely accessible and known as we'd like it to be. And it takes more effort from individuals and businesses to find it. However, the technology has the power to create a better sense of belonging within society and communities. The key things that I've gotten out of this conversation is that it all comes down to basics. It is about communication, asking instead of assuming, educating yourself, and providing education and training opportunities for fellow employees within a company. And ultimately, not being afraid of people who are registered or identify themselves as disabled. They are part of our society, and we just need to create a better community for them to feel part of and belong.
And with lots of the work that I've done, and, you know, big and small companies I've worked with, or I've gone into their offices, and you do find yourself kind of going to the bare basics, you know, when it comes to, you know, disability awareness. Communication is everything, guys. Like, just keep asking questions, don't shy away. Each and every one of us deserve to be a part of society. Like, don't avoid talking to us, don't avoid us in general, you know. You've got to do your bit. Mm-hmm. So like I say, it's just a constant work in progress. It's not an overnight fix, and you're not going to learn everything in one day. It's just an ongoing movement where you'll constantly be learning, and it will do wonders for your business and your perspective on life in general.
Certainly, work in progress. Molly, thank you so much for having this conversation with me and sharing your very personal experiences, as well as giving some invaluable advice to business leaders that I know are listening to the show. I personally have learned from this conversation a lot. However, the most important thing is not to make it a one conversation thing, but keep talking.
Yes, definitely. No, thank you so much for having me. And yeah, I hope that you and the listeners have taken something from it. And thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Molly. I absolutely love this conversation. As I mentioned at the beginning of the podcast, it was important for me to have this conversation from a personal point of view, as well as knowing what these conversations look like on the other side of business. We need to normalize these conversations. Technology will get there. us people need to do a better job of playing our part. We need to educate ourselves first and foremost, and only then we will be able to become more empathetic and inclusive as individuals and build more inclusive teams, businesses, product, public infrastructure and beyond. It is okay to not know it all. I mean, it is impossible. However, our job is not to be ignorant. Be better allies and get comfortable with being uncomfortable. So please share this conversation, keep talking and let me know your thoughts. You can reach me via email, LinkedIn or use hashtag ChangeAgentPodcast on Twitter. Also, please connect to Molly. Her details are in the notes section. Thank you again for listening. Until next time, stay safe.